This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, April 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Monday evening, a fire ravaged Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, destroying its spire and its roof, but much of the medieval structure and its historical treasures were spared. The conflagration came at a moment of political reckoning for France's president, Emmanuel Macron. That night, he was due to give a speech outlining his response to the yellow vest crisis, which has been agitating the country since last November. Instead, Macron rushed to Notre Dame, which he described as the epicenter of Parisian life. He toured the scene, then delivered a televised address the next day, vowing to rebuild the cathedral as soon as possible.
Je vous le dis ce soir avec force. Nous sommes ce peuple de bâtisseurs.
I'm telling you this tonight with force. We are a people of builders. We have so much to rebuild, so yes, we will rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral even more beautifully. And I want this to be done within 5 years. We can do it, and here again we will mobilize. Lauren Collins joins me from Paris to discuss the mood in the city and why this tragedy may offer a possible moment of political renewal for President Macron and France. Lauren, welcome.
Thanks, Dorothy. I wish it were a happier occasion, but I'm glad to be speaking with you nonetheless.
Me too. It's been too long. So just a few weeks before the fire, you were actually inside the forest in Notre Dame, that lattice of wooden beams under the cathedral's roof. You were doing some reporting on the renovations that were then underway. Could you tell us a little bit about what you saw in there?
So I had started thinking about a piece on the renovations in the fall, and I went up kind of in the rafters and around on the balustrades, I guess you would call them, of the belfry towers and all that. I had finally decided I was going to write something at the end of March. And so I think on March 27th, it was, I took a construction elevator up, 200 feet to the top of the roof and was able to poke around in the scaffolding and see everything that was going on up there. And I was there and I was kind of looking out over all of Paris, and it's this incredible experience, both the kind of panorama, but then up close, you see things like there was a little pigeon that had made a nest right in the neck of one of the gargoyles. And so I was thinking, what luck this is to get to do this. And, after Monday, it seems like historical luck more than just a nice thing to have seen.
You wrote about it really vividly for the New Yorker website about the limestone that was so fragile that you brushed a finger against it, it ran like sand through an hourglass. I wondered whether it is believed that the restoration effort might be partly to blame. You interviewed Olivier Baumgartner, a technician who was working on the restoration, who said very poignantly, in wanting to give her a second youth, we have perhaps destroyed her.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, that was no admission of blame on his part. He finished the job on Thursday last week before the fire started on Monday. I think it helps to think of a building like Notre Dame as a living building, kind of like we say the Constitution is a living document. It's never finished. I mean, there's always something falling apart that has to be replaced. I don't think you could ever come to a moment of stasis in the life of a building like that that has evolved over centuries and centuries and centuries and has different parts that are kind of living and evolving and falling apart on very different timelines. But the renovation desperately needed to happen. It got started later than it should have. The money was not exactly pouring in for it. I mean, I was there under the auspices of a foundation that had been put together in this kind of ad hoc manner, just looking to raise money from Americans for the renovation.
I love the story in the Times this morning about Father Fournier, the chaplain of the Paris Fire Department, who led the effort to rescue the treasures, including the crown of thorns and the nail and piece of wood said to have been part of the cross used in the crucifixion.
Well, they had an amazing plan in place. I mean, whatever rounds of blame assigning and finger pointing will go on in the wake of the fire, the firefighters had 100 firefighters who were trained to find and rescue relics. And, they had all of these protocols. I mean, for instance, they didn't use the water cannons at full force out of concern for the rose windows, which, wonderfully and seemingly miraculously were saved. They were able to go in and get these relics that are of historical and also, you know, deep religious importance. I remember, I mean, the thing that really stuck out to me, you know, from the chaplain's testimony was he said that he was inside Notre Dame and that there was an orange and red rain falling down around him.
Also, Notre Dame has such an extraordinary history. It has survived far worse than what it has just been through during the French Revolution, as I've been reading. It was looted and partly destroyed and then rededicated as a temple to the goddess Reason. And in World War II, of course, Hitler had ordered Nazi troops to reduce all of Paris, Notre Dame in particular, to a pile of rubble. So I'm just curious about what the response has been in Paris by Parisians.
That is a multi-part question. I think there are a number of responses. Obviously, the first immediate and most emotional response was, you know, the same devastation and sadness and, you know, unhappy awe, I think, that was felt all over the world. But, you know, when anything like this happens, various debates around it break out very fast. And so, there are a few conversations that are going on. One of them is, what do we do now? Edouard Philippe, who's the prime minister, announced that there's going to be an international competition for architects. And he tweeted, should we rebuild the spire? Should we rebuild it identically? Should it be adapted to the techniques and issues of our era? And of course, that immediately caused a polemic, as the French say. I mean, something that's interesting, you were talking about the history of Notre Dame and its architecture. So in 1831, when Victor Hugo wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame was in abject shape. You know, it was post-revolution. It had been neglected. It was completely falling apart. And so much of what was lost in Monday's fire, the spire and that entire area, was part of a renovation that happened in the 1850s that was led by Eugène Viollet-le-Duc, who also renovated a number of other famous French monuments. Viollet-le-Duc's philosophy was very much, when you're doing a renovation, you're not trying to just restore a building to exactly what it was before. You know, you're trying to make something that resembles the time. So I feel like this competition and this rebuilding could yield something kind of exciting or thrilling or reflective of our era. I mean, you know, there's a way in which you can think of this as an opportunity for the French and the Parisians of 2019 to erect a monument of their time. But obviously, there are a lot of different opinions about that. And that's going to be a long and contentious conversation to come.
And the spire itself, as Adam Gopnik, our colleague, wrote about this week, the spire itself was not an original part of the structure. It was Viollet-le-Duc who built it.
Yeah, the spire was brand new in Notre Dame terms. I mean, in Notre Dame terms, it's practically the spire is to Notre Dame as the pyramid is in front of the Louvre is to the Louvre practically. I mean, when you look at the lifespan of the building. But another conversation that's happening is so very quickly after the extent of the damages became clear, a number of France's richest kind of entrepreneurial families said that they were all going to give money to help with the renovation. There's been a total of 850 million euros raised already. But this is a tricky and a fraught thing coming as it does in the middle of the Gilets Jaunes crisis. There's a controversy that has now arisen around that with people saying, well, how come all this money is sitting around to give to Notre Dame at the same time when nobody can find any money to give to the, you know, the people who are clearly struggling? And, you know, I know that can, and some people have said that sounds kind of like the unhelpful mixing of two issues. But the reason why the debate is a little bit more trenchant than that is because one of the things that the Gilets Jaunes, among other factions of French society, have been upset about is that one of Macron's first acts was to get rid of a wealth tax, to get rid of a tax that applied to the very families that have given so lavishly to this building. So in a way, people are saying, you know, wouldn't it be better if you paid your taxes, and then the state had more money and could actually decide how to deploy that money in the service of Notre Dame and other things.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The president was due to give this important speech on Monday evening about the yellow vests, or gilets jaunes, as you call them in France, that crisis, which has really come to represent very strong public dissatisfaction with his presidency. Maybe just give us a little bit of background on the movement.
Okay, so the gilets jaunes movement has been a series of protests that have been happening every Saturday since November. And kind of the detonator for them, as they say in the French media, was an increase in the tax on gas. But I mean, obviously, it's a movement that represents some long festering resentments and inequalities in French society. So anyway, the Gilets jaunes were, for instance, responsible for the sacking of the Champs-Élysées. I mean, probably, you know, readers have seen images of that. So Macron's political fate has sort of been hanging in the balance. And Monday night, he was due to address the nation, to give a speech on live television announcing major measures, major reforms that he was going to undertake as a response to the Gilets jaunes and then the national conversation that had arisen out of the Gilets jaunes movement. Macron had initiated something he called le grand débat, the great debate, which was kind of a two-month-long listening tour of the country. And he was set to deliver his conclusions that he had drawn from that conversation on Monday night. It's been delayed, and so far it hasn't been announced when he's going to do that.
Tell us a little bit more about the Grand Debat. How did that listening tour go?
The Grand Debat, you know, when he announced it, people, I don't know, there was a lot of skepticism. Okay, a debate is going to solve the problem of people not having enough money to buy food at the end of the month? Probably not. And of course, it hasn't solved it, and we don't know yet what concrete reforms are going to come out of it. But it did, at the very least, buy him both some time and a few points, I think, in public opinion. So what happened is he went around the country, he went to, you know, all the regions of France, and he just held these marathon meetings and basically stood up in front of groups of mayors, groups of citizens, and took flak for hours and hours. I mean, the first one was in front of a group of mayors, and I think he stood up there for 6 hours and just absorbed questions, suggestions, and resentment in his shirt sleeves. There was also one, he convened one with the intellectuals of France, which was broadcast live on the radio, and it went until 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, people were kind of like, people were sneaking out and falling asleep. But I think people appreciated his willingness to put himself in front of the people, I guess, rather than managing the crisis from behind the gates of the Élysée. I went to one of the debates in Corsica, and again, it remains to be seen what concrete measures will come of this, but his grasp of the minutiae of the issues was really impressive. And I think that, if nothing else, has made an impression on people.
And what about the emotional resonance of all of this? Was he able to address that?
I think the jury's out on that. So the Gilets jaunes protests have continued. And there was a woman in her 70s who was very badly hurt at a protest a few weeks ago. She was protesting in a place where the police had forbidden protesting, but she was there and she got knocked over. There's an investigation that's ongoing into whether she was knocked over by the police or not. And Macron, in kind of sending his wishes for her recuperation, couldn't resist saying, I hope she gets better, and maybe she'll next time learn a little bit of sagesse, wisdom. You know, I think a lot of people did not take too kindly to that comment on an emotional level.
There, we have a beautiful cover to commemorate this week. I don't know if you've seen it yet. It's by Bob Stack, and it's called Our Lady. And he rather romantically says, you know, if history teaches us anything, it's that out of the flames can come rebirth. But I wanted to contrast that with some of the more skeptical things that the French press has been saying. Le Monde described the Gilets Jaunes as one of the most serious social crises the country has known for 30 years. So do you think that Macron will be able to use this moment to political advantage?
If nothing else, the fire has bought him time. It'll be interesting to see how the architectural restoration dovetails with this program of national renewal. The only thing that is going to matter really are the reforms that he announces, and whether they are sufficiently extensive to satisfy and to heal the social fracture that the Gilets Jaunes have both identified and in ways amplified.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
You're welcome, Dorothy.
Lauren Collins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of When in French, Love in a Second Language. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review the program on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with assistance from Kylie Warner. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.